Yes, hi, this is Rocker T passing through. You know, when I'm in Portland, checking for 90.7 cable, for real. This is the One Love Jam Down with a DJ like Ja Will, for real. Now my selector.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. One of my guests this week is Scott Miller. He's the guest curator of Human Rights After the Holocaust, a permanent new exhibit at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education. Scott is the former curator at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus in person, Scott.
It's my pleasure. It's an important topic.
So you've come to Portland because they're reopening the OJM and it's expanded, and part of the new expansion is a new permanent exhibit about human rights. And the sort of entry point is human rights as we know it, as declared by the UN, was triggered by the Holocaust against the Jews in Second World War.
Yes. The first of all, I'd like to say that this institution, the Oregon Jewish Museum Center for Holocaust Education, really has a sacred obligation to ask and try to answer the questions, have we learned the lessons from the Holocaust? And these were questions that were asked immediately after the Holocaust. What are the lessons? The world was still absorbing what had happened. And in December of 1948, the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights with the consciousness that what had taken place in Europe, the destruction of European Jewry and persecution of millions of other Europeans based on race, religion, political affiliation, was a crime against humanity that had surpassed all other crimes. And in response, the UN General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the idea being the inherent and inalienable rights of all human beings to freedom, dignity, and justice, and protection from oppression, violence and terrorism, slavery, racism, and discrimination, and genocide. The protection against these are sacrosanct. They're the natural rights of every human being. A little different than civil rights. Civil rights are a human right, but human rights are not exactly the same as civil rights. Civil rights are specific personal rights granted through government laws or policies. But human rights, as defined by the United Nations, are not reliant on any governmental action, and they are belong to all human beings by virtue of being human. Mm-hmm. That was something that was not understood, and that was something that was grossly violated during the Holocaust.
So you have panels here to distinguish that. You have picture of Jackie Robinson and
right.
Desegregation of baseball.
Right.
Truman, headline, Truman wipes out segregation in armed forces. So these are civil rights where
right.
government can intervene.
Yes. Yes.
Human rights. So the UN says something like, humans have all these rights.
Right.
You know, what's to make a government in Malaysia or,
right.
you know, somewhere around the world take any notice of that?
Right. Well, that's a very good question. And in fact, human rights, though they were defined and enshrined by the United Nations in 1948 as something sacrosanct, the idea is that they have been abused. That I would say the world has not in full learned the lessons of the Holocaust. And this exhibition is really dedicated to showing these abuses really since the end of World War II,
mm-hmm.
how human rights have been violated.
It's a single room exhibit. Most of it is sort of panels on walls. There are some videos and some vitrines. You pick out 5 of the 30 articles from the Declaration of Human Rights.
Yes.
Why don't we read one? Read them.
So all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights.
All are equal before the law and entitled without any discrimination to equal protection of the law.
Everyone has the right to seek and enjoy in other countries asylum from persecution.
The will of the people shall be the basis of the authority of government.
Everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion.
Right. So these are kind of like the big five.
Right, right.
Very abstract concepts. So you've sort of rendered these in, right. Well, you've provided examples of their violation, basically.
Yes, all over the overseas and also here in the United States. We do it through very powerful photographs, mm-hmm. through oral history, interviews with victims of these human rights abuses, and with artifacts as well,
mm-hmm.
original documentation.
Those are panels which you have to read and look at photos. In this vitrine you have under Disappeared Voices, so in Syria in 2011, Al-Assad, you know, imprisoned a lot of people, and one guy,
yes.
was getting out, and he wrote down the names of 82 fellow prisoners so that when he left, he could alert their families and say, these people are not disappeared or dead, they're still alive.
That's
give
right.
them some hope. And what are these fabric pieces in?
So the individual you were referring to who was arrested and wrote down the 82 names was a journalist and human rights activist in Syria, Mansour Omari, who was arrested in 2012 as part of Assad's general crackdown of really anyone who opposed the government, especially journalists and human rights activists. Omari was in prison where he was tortured, and he was arrested, as I said, in 2012. And after a year of incarceration, he was asked to sign some papers, and he knew that he was being released. That was a sign that he was being released. And he, you know, felt the need to really inform the families of those incarcerated, that tell them that they were still alive. Because again, when one was incarcerated in Syria, they really disappeared. There was no record of what happened to them. So Mansour and a few fellow prisoners took these five strips of cloth that you were looking at, and with blood and rust wrote the names of the 82 prisoners, who also gave them the phone numbers of their families. Now it's faded over time, so you have mm-hmm. to look very, very closely. But I find this so moving, so powerful. It's an act of resistance on the part of Mansour and his fellow prisoners to do this. And it's a memorial to their names. A lot of these prisoners have since re-disappeared and likely were killed. There may be very few alive mm-hmm. Today. We
kind
don't know.
Kind of looks like Dead Sea Scrolls, or you know, the writing is kind of cuneiform, you know, like they were
yes.
writing with a stick almost.
Yes,
very,
yes,
very
they were
blocky,
with a stick and
that,
chicken yeah. bone. And keeping these, this is in Arabic.
Yeah.
As well, so.
Across the way here?
Yes.
This section, Bangladesh, Bosnia, Myanmar, South America, and there are some artifacts from Rwanda.
Yes.
So Rwanda is a case where the government turned two tribal people against each other, and it does mention that the UN kind of had lots of warning about this would happen.
Yes, yes.
But didn't do anything.
Yes, this is under the category of genocide, which is in and of itself a human rights abuse,
mm-hmm.
and it's certainly the most lethal and destructive of all the human rights abuses, because we're talking about mass murders of tens, hundreds of thousands, even millions. The sad fact is that since the Holocaust, or since even the last 30 years, the world has witnessed too many genocides, and many of them were preventable. Now, in Rwanda, the Hutu tribe and the Tutsi peoples had lived together for many years. These two peoples shared a culture, religion, language. The Tutsis enacted really a genocide against the Hutus and were responsible for the mass murder of hundreds of thousands of really fellow Rwandans. Again, I want to emphasize this was mass murder. There were reports from the United Nations that the Hutus were accumulating weapons, and there were warnings that there could be a mass genocide, and there was virtually no reaction from the world. And this is in the age, in the 1990s, of mass media. We're not talking about during the 1940s, where there were many in the United States who did not know what was going on in Europe, did not, we're not aware of what today we call the Holocaust. But this was, you know, people already had cable and, of course, radio and television, which they didn't have. Well, they had radio, they didn't have television during the Holocaust.
At the climax of the exhibit, there are three big screens that talk about activism in Jewish communities, in Oregon, and around the world.
Yes.
And these are kind of touch screens where, what do you hope people will get from this?
Right. So we wanted this exhibition really to end with some hope. We wanted to really raise the moral consciousness of visitors here, and we want people to feel empowered that they can do for victims of human rights abuses what the world could not do for the Jews during the Holocaust, or what the world did not do for the Jews during the Holocaust in the 1940s, that there are many mechanisms, be it protest, be it working or volunteering for international aid organizations, be it government legislation, that to be active members of society to try to affect change, and that could be done in the context of your own, say, cultural religious community. This is the Oregon Jewish Museum Center for Holocaust Education, so we focus on Jewish communities, but could be activism locally. In this case, this is an Oregon museum, so we're talking about Oregon as locally, but it could be anywhere locally or anywhere in the world, activism around the world. And it's really just, it's stunning and gratifying to see that women in Iran and women in Afghanistan are protesting the Taliban and protesting for their rights. So when you see women in those very oppressive regimes protesting for the rights, you begin to think all the more so we can do it here in Portland or in New York or wherever everyone lives.
And then there's a place where you can write on a kind of, looks like a paper label.
Yes, where you can,
on a grid.
Yes. And it's the question is posed is, how do you turn hope into action? We want people to leave here hopeful, but the idea that hope then turns into action. And we ask people to write down some of their ideas.
How do they turn hope into action? So one is, I participate in protests and marches.
There are many groups that work together, groups that have known oppression. So for example, the Jewish community and the Yiger community in the United States have worked very carefully, closely together on behalf of fighting for to end the persecution and genocide against the Yigers in China. And they even had, across the United States over the past few years, Freedom Seders. And this is from the Passover story, the book of the Passover Seder, the Haggadah. It's a joint Jewish and Yiger Haggadah telling the story of the persecution of the Jews and the persecution of the Yigers. This year we are slaves, next year may we all be free, which is a traditional ending to the Jewish Haggadah, but it also is very applicable to the Yigers today. And it's, I think, a wonderful story of groups coming together.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. One of my guests this week was Scott Miller. He's the guest curator of Human Rights After the Holocaust at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education in the Park Blocks, Portland. And he's also the former curator at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. Thanks very much for taking the time to come on KBOO, Scott.
Thank you for having me.
My second guest this week is Judy Margles. She is the director of the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education. She's also talking about human rights after the Holocaust. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again, Judy.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
This is the fourth of your core permanent exhibits. So you have art things that come and go, but you've always had these three core ones, and this is the fourth. What are the first three?
Yeah, so this we have three exhibitions upstairs. One is about the Holocaust. We are the Center for Holocaust Education. One is called Oregon Jewish Stories, which helps visitors understand the trajectory of the Jewish experience in Oregon. And our third core exhibit is called Discrimination and Resistance, an Oregon Primer, really helping our visitors understand the somewhat sorry history of how anybody who wasn't white was treated in this state when they first arrived.
Mm-hmm. So the museum has always kind of drifted, I'd say, away. I mean, not just about Jewish culture and people it covers other people, and it covers other minorities or types of oppression, that kind of angle. So what was it about human rights that you wanted to have human rights as the big exhibit on the ground floor?
Yeah, no, thank you again for that question. In our Holocaust exhibition upstairs, we say quite succinctly, why study the Holocaust? And in that, we say that we studied the Holocaust to make connections with others, because we know since the Holocaust that genocide continues to persist. So we've always felt that our mission wasn't quite complete. And then we had this opportunity to purchase this gallery and really delve into this very sorry history of human rights abuses since the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. And as the panels make clear on the way in, this sort of human rights takes off as a concept after the Holocaust, because of the Holocaust. And things that happen to the Jews become applied to all humanity. That's why the introduction section is really illuminating. Let's go over to this piece from Syria, the man who was in prison, and he wrote down the names of fellow prisoners so he could sneak out the names on a piece of cloth and tell their families they were still alive. How did you meet him?
His name is Mansour Omri. So Mansour was a Syrian human rights activist. He was living in Damascus, and in 2012 he was imprisoned in a prison in Damascus. He'd been working at a documentation center, and his job was to document the disappeared. So he was rounded up, imprisoned, and actually found out he was to be released. And knowing that that was going to be happening, he had they had nothing in prison. They had absolutely nothing to write on. They had nothing to write with. So they took a shirt, they ripped it up into five pieces of cloth, and then a fellow prisoner wrote the names of each prisoner and their phone numbers on these cloth strips. Mansour smuggled them out of the prison in Damascus. He was given asylum in Sweden upon his release. He, our curator for this exhibition, Scott Miller, who lived in DC, knew of Mansour, contacted him, and he agreed to loan us the cloth strips. He did not want to ship them. I was able to travel to Sweden. I spent 48 hours in Stockholm to pick them up. Meeting Mansour was an entirely transformative experience for me in many ways. First of all, to meet directly with him, hear his story, see him. He was beaten and tortured in prison. You could see the effects of this on his face. He told me of these 82 names. Four are known to have survived and they're safe. Seven are confirmed dead, and the remainder, we don't know. They are disappeared. So that was heartbreaking. He also told me, which makes sense, it seems easy to say, yes, he recorded the phone numbers, he called all the moms, let them know where their sons were, that they were safe. He said how emotionally wrenching this was for him. But the thing I really wanted to say about meeting Mansour, which I found when I've met other human rights activists, he had this optimism in him that was almost hard to believe, that he just felt so, he was so thankful for his own safety. He was so thankful that countries like the United States protected immigrants. I mean, things that we who live here sort of chafe a little bit against, but I think to do the kind of work that Mansour does, he has to be perennially optimistic. And I really felt that from him. So the visit, as I used the word earlier, was transformative for me.
Mm-hmm. So he actually credited the U.S. with helping him in his work?
Mm-hmm. He did. He recognizes some of the issues that are going on here. He was talking about certain Republican politicians rather disdainfully. All that is there. He's extremely educated and knowledgeable, but yet he does hold the United States as this beacon of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
I would say about this exhibition that it is divided into four sort of unique sections. One of the things that we really wanted to explore in this exhibition is what happened after the war. What happened after, you know, close to 11 million people were slaughtered in this war. 1948, the Human Rights Declaration was enacted, right? The United Nations, thanks to Eleanor Roosevelt, there were 30 principles in this Human Rights Declaration. But what's so clear when you look at the principles, and we have them all on exhibit that people can come and read them, most of them are being abused on a daily basis. That was really worth helping our visitors to understand. We also wanted to ground this exhibit in, if I may use that word, the memory of the Holocaust. We are a Jewish institution. We want to view things through a Jewish lens. We want to make connections with other human rights violations and genocides, but through this unique Jewish lens that we have. This is why the exhibit is called Human Rights After the Holocaust, and why the very first section is looking at issues of crimes against humanity, refugees. What are human rights as opposed to civil rights? That's the first section of the exhibit. Then we're taking five of these principles from the Human Rights Declaration and unpacking them by using stories from various countries where human rights abuses occur on a daily basis. It is really important to point out we are not looking elsewhere. We're not only looking to countries in Asia or countries in Europe or countries in South America. We're looking at our very own country, the United States. So for every section of this exhibition, we are uncovering human rights abuses before our very eyes. Mm-hmm. That's the second section, looking at human rights violations. The third section is about genocide. Mm-hmm. Genocide is a word that was actually coined because of the Holocaust. It was coined by a Polish Jewish lawyer. His name was Raphael Lemkin. So it's a brand new word for us at the time, right? And again,
killing a whole tribe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Just obliterating people, right? The exhibition is not exhaustive. Of course, we can't speak about every violation and abuse and genocide that is occurring. We have taken seven stories that we've uncovered. The whole exhibition is modular. We will change it. So there might be a day where we say, okay, we will replace a certain country and a certain genocide with something else coming. The example I tend to use is Sudan. We buttoned up the text for this exhibition on March 1st. And then the war in Sudan exploded. We're not covering that in this exhibition. I would hope within the next 6 months to 9 months that we're changing out a panel and actually discussing that. The fourth section of the exhibition is where the hope is, right? We have a rule in my institution. We talk about some very distressing things. We do want to give people something to hope for. I mentioned Mansour and his perennial optimism. In a way, this is an ode to these human rights activists. In fact, we dedicated the exhibition to human rights activists everywhere and to Holocaust survivors. So our fourth exhibition is on activism. We call it, What Can We Do? We, human beings who are visitors, who are attending this exhibition, and what can the world do, right? That's really what we're trying to do. So we divided it. There are three interactive screens where we're looking at activism in Jewish communities, activism in Oregon, activism around the world. Mm-hmm. And these are just many different examples of what people like you and me, Joseph, can do when we're in communities and seeing injustices. They're not big, explosive ideas. Many of them are attending marches. Many of them are joining and working with refugees. All sorts of opportunities to use your voice and try and make a difference. We also take on the subject of hope, and we are explicitly asking our visitors, how do you turn hope into action? And we have, it's an interactive where visitors are invited mm-hmm. to actually say what they want.
Well, you've got some new ones.
We've got lots and lots. So
what is this one? Strong relationships across lines between groups.
How beautiful is that, right? Just make community. I fight to be myself and create a welcome, safe, and open space for others to do the same. I try to listen to other stories. Hope is born between people being together, mm-hmm. right? So many, just an opportunity for people to come. We say, we have a quote by Rebecca Solnit, one of my heroes. She wrote a very, very beautiful book about hope. Hope calls for action. Action is impossible without hope. We also have a quote from Elie Wiesel, a Holocaust survivor. Hope is a gift, an offering that only we human beings can give to one another. The point we're trying to make here is hope in and of itself is not enough. Hope has to turn into action. So we're just inviting people to think, where is their action? Where are they going to center what they're going to do when they leave this museum and feel compelled to do something?
Mm-hmm. You also redid the cafe because people need to sit down and process at the end of a tour of this place.
I'm so glad you mentioned the cafe. Jacob and Sons, the cafe is now Jacob and Sons at Lefty's. This exhibit, we do have a panel sort of trying to help our visitors understand that when they enter into this exhibition, they're going to be confronted with some distressing material. The cafe is a place where they can go and sit and sort of process what they've taken in the exhibition and talk to their friends, talk to staff. We're all here very eager to talk to visitors to hear what they have to say. In addition to the cloth strips that I brought back from Sweden, owned by Mansour Omari, the Syrian human rights activist, we were very, very fortunate to borrow other objects from the exhibition from a museum in Bangladesh and a museum in Rwanda. Particularly poignant are the one of the objects from Bangladesh, which is a book, The Magic Mountain, by Thomas Mann. I'm sure many of you are familiar with it. It has a bullet hole in it. So the person who was being shot with the bullet, where the bullet actually saved his life because it went through the book, he was put in prison. He did die in prison after his arrest. Other objects from Rwanda include a child's shoe, a rosary bead, and an identity card. These were all items that were exhumed. So they were victims found when they were when their bodies were exhumed. Scott Miller, our curator for the exhibition, he always pointed to the rosary beads as something he was very pleased that it made it into the exhibition, because it actually gave him comfort to think that the person who owned it had this comfort with them. They had their rosary bead with them in prison. They died with it.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week were Judy Margles. She's the director of the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education in Old Town Portland, and Scott Miller. He was the guest curator of Human Rights After the Holocaust, a new core exhibit at the reopened Jewish Museum. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Judy.
Thank you so much for having me, and I invite everyone to visit. I'm
Estás escuchando a KBOO Portland en el 90.7 FM, K2H2 BH Philomath en el 104.3 FM y K220 HR Hood River en el 91.9 FM.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 27 de junio del 2023. Putin le dice a los mercenarios de Wagner que se unan al ejército ruso o se enfrenten al exilio en Bielorrusia. Zelensky visita tropas de primera línea. La administración Biden anuncia nuevas armas para Ucrania. La UNICEF advierte que 100.000 niños refugiados sudaneses en Chad se enfrentan a nuevos peligros. Colonos israelíes asaltan.